Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls weekly 2-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We are seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 125, section 2. If someone could mute their mic, it would help. It's our Ark, Jesus of Nazareth. What a transcendent service. If through this revelation, the Son of Man should be recovered from the tomb of traditional theology and be presented as the living Jesus. That's what we're trying to do here by studying the childhood of Jesus, also a living person and well worth studying. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. With us tonight, Dr. Chris Halverson, Andrea Barnes, David Tucker, and you. Won't you join us here in our study of this marvelous text? Call it up as you see fit and settle in for about 1% of your week. Hello there, Dr. Chris.
Hello, Brad. Hello, David and Andrea. Everyone has joined us again. This is, turning into a very delightful arc here, you know, like you were saying, Brad, of trying to resurrect the real Jesus from theologies that have kind of become ever more divorced from, you know, the literalness of his humanity and the direct engagement of the physical challenges, you know, and all kinds, you know, because there's so much focus on the public ministry, it's just it all gets abstracted from the real Jesus quite easily. So I'm enjoying definitely working through it here in this very focused way, and hope everyone else that's listening is feeling a little bit more of a living relationship with the truth of his life. So we'll pick up just as Jesus is about to be so lost in his efforts to reform his consciousness that he totally forgets that he's a child with two parents, and we all know that what happens next. So hope everyone enjoys the show here.
Right on. Well, thank you for that, Chris. And yes, I've been appreciating all of the little details and just relating it back to here and now, as I always do. It's always a fine time when we're in part 4 of the Urantia book. I just remembered, you know, you mentioned, was it Bethel, the town that they avoided on their way to Jerusalem? And I thought, I've heard that name before. And I remembered my mother grew up on Bethel Road in deep rural Mississippi. So I'm like, I knew I'd known that name since I was a child. And so she grew up on House of God Road. That's lovely. And of course, that's Anne. She's the original founder of the show here. So we're glad that she grew up on Bethel Road. And Andrea, good evening to you. How are you doing?
Good evening, Brad. I think that's so neat. Your mom grew up on Bethel Road. Yeah, I think that's lovely.
It is.
Yeah, definitely sounds better than the path of sin and death.
Yeah.
Would that be Beelzebub Road? Or?
Yeah, something like that. Lucifer Court, whatever. Everything's going fine with me. I'm looking forward to tonight's study. Thanks a bunch for the introduction.
Uh-huh. All right. And David, good evening to you, sir. How are you doing? And thank you for taking the time to tell us what we were up to last week. Looking forward to hearing about it.
Absolutely. Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Dr. Chris. Good evening, Andrea. And hello to all those that are listening to us live and in the archive. I had a really good experience writing this. And it's based off of something that Dr. Chris said a little bit earlier. I really want to say that the years of studying here has brought a new meaning to the term study for me. And it's really expanded my understanding of what it means to, like, really study. And so I approach things completely different because of my experience on SOS and the Friday Night Open Discussion Groups and the different ways that we've connected with each other over the years. So I just really want to say thank you to all of you guys, including Kermit and James and Anne and everyone else that listens so faithfully, all of our listeners and all the work that everyone puts into Zabriel and Elizabeth and all of those. So I just want to say thank you guys all for being here. And for today's summary, we started talking about growing in faith. So the mission of a bestowal son is the attempt to foster growth of faith in their public ministry. However, he can only uplift a something. He cannot uplift a no thing. The growth of faith is predicated on having a faith to begin with that can be grown. Step one is to enter the kingdom by believing God's promises and following God's instructions, faith. Being given the fifth epical revelation as we were, it has the ability to take someone who hungers and thirsts for righteousness forward from being born again to potentially being born again again and even beyond. But we must be born again first in that initiation of it becoming of our will that God, the Father's perfect will, be done. Is God first in your life and in every aspect that you can conceive of? Then you have been initiated and have successfully supplied enough of that favorable condition to have been born again. Is God anywhere else other than first for you? Then you supply not the favorable conditions to be grown. And you require more time and experience to come to that recognition first. Set a guard upon what you put first in all aspects of your lives so that God and his instructions come into every thought and conversation that you take part in. Then of a certainty, you are in the kingdom and can be lifted up from there. None of us began already in the kingdom, not even Jesus of Nazareth. How he got into the kingdom and how he managed to stay into the kingdom without failing the test is why that of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Endarkenment. The endarkenment we're speaking of is brought about when people fail to begin or cease to continue, challenging themselves to have an unnatural mode of mind. Our minds have been evolving over the last million years, and it's not a mere passive darkness that results from the absence of personality management. At this point, it becomes an active darkness because our minds are spiritualized more now than they have ever been on our planet. Without a willful consecration of ourselves to the light, it becomes an active darkness, fueled by that spiritualized mind that can unconsciously choose for us. Left on to itself in a world steeped in concepts based on the material, the human, and the temporal, your mind will make choices without your awareness of it. You must choose to frame your mind with a consecration to the spiritual, divine, and eternal. A conscious choice to do that directs your mind, conscious or not, away from error, evil, sin, and iniquity. We picked up reading in paper 125, Jesus at Jerusalem, and Jesus' great disillusionment came about because of his insight from within. In other words, because he was taking delight in cultivating courageous and independent cosmic thinking. He was beginning to see that all was not what others would have him believe it was. He could recognize via his cosmic intuitions what was logical, right, and spiritual, and see through to the reality of any given subject. And he was doing it at an ever-increasing pace with clarity and precision. He can see into what was in someone's inner life and judge accordingly. Can you see through the piety white paint and outwardly appearance that somebody portrays? Can you recognize when someone has humbly submitted themselves to God's will? Set a guard upon your eyes and your ears so that all that passes through them does so via your insight first, so that you may better develop your recognition of sophistry and all the pitfalls that come from it. Our use of the second and third cosmic intuition is not for judgment of the eternal destiny of someone or whether or not the capital J judges will give them the big thumbs down or thumbs up, but we'll give you the necessary insight to know who you are potentially exhibiting a devotion to. Are their ideals godly? Or have you unwittingly exhibited a devotion to someone who is devoted to a godless ideal? We've seen Jesus get to the point of the initial born again level with some definitive insight on that sixth level of meaning, his moral intuition at this stage of his life. His concept of ideals is more definitive to him now. And like never before, this moment, and combined with his temperament, he got a burning desire to voice his disdain to anything that went in opposition to those ideals. If Jesus didn't have the proper guidance and the preconditioning, he could have zealously got himself in a situation where his life could have ended right then and there. For the first time in Jesus' life, he has the ability to become fanatical now, and he must deal with that, and he does. It begins to dawn on us the real significance as to why we call him master. We can recognize what he had to go through and why it's so vital for us to understand it. We must also go and do likewise. Judge not ism. In time, we must discriminate everything. Jesus tells us not to judge the eternal consequences of another individual, but everything short of eternity must be judged accordingly, lest we find ourselves mistakenly influenced. When the blind lead the blind, they both fall into the pit. We have a say relative to our own blindness, but we don't have any say whether or not someone else is blind, despite the natural urge to fix someone else's blindness. If you are blind and cannot see whether or not someone else is blind, and you follow them, then you're following them into the pit. If you cannot penetrate through the spiritual candy on the outside, then you're not real, and thereby devoid of any survival value. Until we have residence on Havona, we must judge. Each of us needs to develop that ever greater discriminating ability through taking delight in cultivating. That gives us the recognition a person is on the path towards sin and death, and I shouldn't follow them despite how much attraction or intriguing ideas they may have about any particular topic. Now, more than ever, those on the path towards sin and death appear to be good. None of them are wearing a capital V on their chest to state that they're a villain. No, they're doing, quote-unquote, good by seemingly serving or something else that appeals to our ideals or notion of service. And without that discriminating eye, your sixth adjutant will zealously take on that path with them. Matthew 10:16. Behold, I am sending you out like sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. When all is said and done, you and me and each of us will have to stand on our own two feet, courageously and independently. Cosmic thinking. And there ends my summary.
Terrific, David. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for putting the time into that. I like how you riffed on the falling into the pit. That was brought out as a very vivid metaphor. It's one of those things that we've heard many times in our lives, but when you really expound upon what that means, you know, the watching a blind person lead another blind person, it's very cautionary for us, especially in these days, in the waters that we're swimming in, as I increasingly am fond of saying when referring to our culture, the Western culture as it finds itself. We all swim in the waters, but are you putting your oars in? I guess I'm mixing my metaphors. You're in a boat, you have oars, you're not swimming, but there's still some water. Anyway, yeah. Any thoughts or clarifications? Yeah.
I think the sixth adjutant causes us to mix metaphors.
well, I just want you to know real quick that I was sitting in an outdoor cafe one time, and I actually did see a blind person leading another blind person. They both had walking sticks, and one was pulling the other one from behind, and I thought, oh, this could go bad.
Right here. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, we all know that the parables and just every way he tried to communicate, he was constantly trying to use the parallels between the material and the spiritual as analogies, so that us lowly blobs of protoplasm that don't have any immediate ability to engage at a spirit substance level, to engage reality at that level. We have some means of we can reflect upon the nature of the material phenomenon, and because of our encirclement in the Holy Spirit, it's possible for us to make that transition across that parallel divide and see, I see there's a truth in the material setting that is equally applicable to my personality management, to the spiritual, it's not just Jesus's technique, or if I use the hourglass analogy of total deity, it's not just my technique. I mean, it is the only way to for a human to begin to sense the truth is by leveraging off the material. There's no other option.
Yeah.
And if you don't try to leverage off the material, if you just play with it directly, then you're that passive child of darkness. It seems, when you explain it, it's just that, it's just that mere passive. I'm trying to clarify. But one of the reasons why the revelators designate that darkness is, not because of the limited nature of what it is immediately, factually. It's the fact that if you don't change that, it doesn't stay in that immature, embryonic darkness. It grows.
Negative growth, yeah.
Yes, you give it, your personality, encompasses that, and via that deity influence, it grows. And so, it's just very important to, as you were pointing out, David, to, to set a watch and to catch this in the early stages, because you're looking very intently.
Mm-hmm.
You are trying to step aside and focus in. We're going to read about Jesus doing that very thing here, as we've already seen him doing some already, because you have to. You can't just think that you're going to pick up on these subtle things, as you're just flippantly passing by them. They need to be caught early, because if you don't stop them, it's not like they're just going to sit there. They're going to snowball.
Yeah, I think about that often with Lucifer. Like, I often wonder, what if he, before he went public, what if he had a recognition and realized what he was saying was illogical? Might he have stopped at that point, would he have not gone all the way to iniquity? And I think I'm speaking to the spirit of what you're saying here, Chris, is that the further we allow this to go on and develop, the harder it is to right the ship, essentially. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yes, definitely. And, all the king's horses and all the king's men, necessarily can't fix this. I mean, they also tell you that way before he went public, when it was just the beginning little, a snowball in his head, people were engaging him, right? Celestials, above him were, sitting down and trying to have a conversation and get him to recognize this, and, he just wouldn't have it. And so that pride thing can just short circuit. You see, you know, that's why, you know, they always hold up pride as, you know, is sort of this straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, if you just, if you haven't gotten control of that pride, it doesn't matter how many people or how many circumstances kind of highlight, whoops, this is not, you know, the path I want to be on. You push that aside.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, I mean, there's, you know, you couldn't possibly have a better mentor to help you with this than incarnate Creator Son, as Jesus of Nazareth, literally sitting down with you and talking with you face to face. And, you know, countless people rejected him.
Right.
You know?
Including
like,
one of the apostles.
Are you suggesting that I'm not perfect? Well, you know, it's so insidious how easy it is for us to shove aside all the warning signs. Right? You can literally have a mystery monitor, a divine secret that warns, and you push it aside every warning, and you know, it's like you're swishing away a housefly that's bothering you. So, I mean, that's just what you're up against. You know, and so, again, you can't overemphasize how important it is to look at these early stages of Jesus' religious life and how he lived it and see what he was up to, how serious he had to get about this issue so that he didn't get, you know, off on that initial tangent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I shudder when you say that, to think like how often I might have nudged away something that was a warning, maybe that I didn't properly discern, or, you know, you get these little thoughts that come into your head throughout your day as you're having this conversation with yourself. And at some point you start to realize like, oh, am I just thinking that myself? Or, you know, either way, it sounds pretty good. Maybe I should follow that instruction. You know, you get a little questionable about what you should start entertaining.
It's
not to emphasize, you know, the negative all the time. I mean, that's not the point. It's just, you know, all we're doing is we're not, accentuating the positive or accentuating the negative. You know, it's just a neutral fact. Jesus had to do this, so we all have to do this too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what kind of a thought is it to think that, well, Jesus had to do it, but I don't have to. I'm more special.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so absurd. And so just, you know, just let it be the fact of our existence that one must do this in order to overcome your feet of clay.
Yeah.
Feet of clay are exactly what the analogy suggests. They're not ascendable. Right? They just, you know, weather down into the dirt again. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
By grace, they come up out of the dirt for a period of time to see if you can get an ascendable soul developed that is of survival value, but they don't endure.
Mm-hmm.
you get maybe 100 years out of it these days, if you're lucky.
You're just given this incredible opportunity by God to ascend from the deepest depths to the highest heights.
Amen.
So, it's just that simple. Every long-time Urantia Book reader, don't have to be that long, you know, can quote that line of all human knowledge.
Yeah.
Is it just a platitude? Or is it what David brought out in his review?
Yeah.
Is it a living challenge?
And that's the nature of this evolutionary domain, this time and space domain we're in. You know, something you said a few minutes ago reminded me of this. This is another example of the longer you sit with this book and really start to reflect on the authors. Over in paper 66, a Melchizedek, who's been around the block for a while, is like completely admitting to us his humiliation. Like he said, well, Caligastia left for his assignment, and I didn't for one moment think that he would ever betray his trust. I lacked insight. And Melchizedek, this being vastly more wise and older than us, admits at the end of this paragraph, I did not then so fully understand the subtleties of personality pride. So we're face to face here every day with subtleties of personality pride, but it's all too easy for us to tell ourselves, oh, there's nothing subtle going on. I must be okay. I don't have any pride. Everything seems fine because I feel good. Now, Melchizedek noticed, had failed to have insight and had to humble himself.
Right. Yeah. Not only does he have all those, you know, countless millions of years of experience, but his mom and dad are gods.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean,
big shoes to
my
fill.
Mom and dad, you know, biologically are blobs of protoplasm. Okay, I mean, there's a bit of a contrast there, and yet, look at, I mean, even that Melchizedek, see, you know, has blind spots. Yeah, so, you know, see, every time a Melchizedek, you know, does an oops like that, you know, if for no other reason he's sent to a little brushing up on it class. it's like, you know, just like David said in the review, you must never assume that you got this.
Yeah.
Right.
You have to constantly challenge yourself, right? You know, even if you're a Melchizedek. So, right, it's just, again, like I said, it's just the reality of what it's like outside of the central universe. No one's an exception to that rule. You know, like you were saying, okay, if I get into Havona, okay, do I have to, constantly be on my guard, trying to penetrate through the whited sepulcher of everyone around me? It's like, no, everyone there either has achieved a perfection of purpose, or they were created with perfection of purpose. By definition, they all have perfection of purpose. There's no false purpose.
No blind spot.
Possible. You don't have to try to scrape the white paint off and make sure it's white deeper down.
Why is this necklace turning green on my neck? It said it was gold.
Yeah. Why do I have this stain around my neck? Yeah. We're trying to make sure, you know, I mean, that was brilliant what you said in highlighting, you know, why that sentence, of all human knowledge. Or another one, I mean, that you highlighted, again, it's just right there facing it. They called him master. Okay, there would be no validity except some sort of just, I'm not worthy, I want to worship you mentality. There would be no validity to that designation if one, you know, if salvation was innate and you didn't have to go through some mastering process.
Right.
He called him master because he mastered what we all must master. Mm-hmm. Not because, you know, we all prostrated ourselves when the glow-in-the-dark beings came down from on high.
Yeah.
All right? It's like, no, you have to equal him. And, of course, like we pointed out, it's even more daunting to think about. You're going to graduate, if you ascend, you're going to graduate eventually from the local universe. In other words, in that sense, you transcend him.
Oh, because experientially he hadn't gone through that process? Is that what you're saying?
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, you're literally leaving the local here. You're transcending it.
Sure.
Okay,
right.
The literal sense. Yeah. I didn't think about it like that. Yeah.
You know, so it's just, you know, so, I mean, obviously you have to be careful and qualify that and everything. You know, it's not much, you know.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, just in a simple, immediate thought, it's like, huh, he's still just the master son of this local universe, and I'm going to transcend this local universe.
Hmm.
Now,
well,
you know, we
qualifier.
Yeah, you know, we sort of go back and forth between descending sons and ascending sons, and you know, they both end up on the same ground when the grand universe is settled in light and life.
Hmm.
Okay, so you don't literally transcend him. You know, in some way he can't transcend the finite. It's like, no, we all get to the same endpoint, but right, but in this near term, I'm leaving the local universe. You know, even more so. You know, even though he can kind of go out and about, the Creative Mother Spirit can't.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in a very literal sense, I'm transcending that God. You know, and beginning to function transcendent of her nature. Yeah, so it just when that challenge, you know, and culminating perfection of purpose in order to get into the central universe, you have this very high challenge when you look down the road. So it's not surprising that there might be something very immediately challenging right now to you.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, you couldn't have such a far destiny. Because that far destiny is the actualization of some initial potential that was vast. So how do you potentialize yourself with such vastness right now? You're not going to do it by just going, well, you know, I'm already there to begin with. I don't have to do anything.
I got my ticket. Yeah.
Go ahead, Andrea.
Well, you brought up that question. You posed that question, and I said, yeah, how do you? How do you do that?
That's why, of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value. I mean, we have this incredible resource now that you can study in detail about how one person did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't know how Elijah got to, you know, fusion or some of the others, but we've got
Enoch long before him. Or right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We don't even have any sort of intimate way to leverage off of John the Baptist. You know, even though his nature, his life has been expanded a bit in the Revelation. Okay, but they don't start with, you know, when John the Baptist was 3, and then they follow him, you know, until he's 4, and then until he's 5. It's like, no, you've got one, you know, completely laid out example of how a human can achieve, in essence, the only way that a human can achieve eternal life.
Yeah.
That's why they've given us this story.
Yeah.
But you need to approach it starting with the truth, not starting with the facts, as we often say here. You know, don't avoid the temptation to turn part 4 into a Trivial Pursuit night. You know, how many charcoal drawings did Jesus draw on the floor by the time he was 10? Like, no, just stop with the, I mean, maybe that's a fun parlor game, but that won't. That attitude, that approach won't lead you to the truth. Now, we're trying to find the truth of his life.
Yeah, we're
let alone, you know, in that factual mode. I mean, I have so many more facts about Jesus now than the Christians do. So, you know, my Jesusism, you know, is even more blindly reverential.
Yeah, it's a concern. You know, I understand the spirit in which it was done, but you know, there are folks who have found a first century fishing boat dredged up from the Sea of Galilee, and they've got it on display, and your Urantia book readers photograph it and say, this must have been one of Jesus's boats. I mean, you know, maybe there's some evidence, but boy, talk about a whole new brand of fetishism, and you know, I know something you don't, ism, among readers of this revelation. I mean, great, he built boats, but what of it? You know, he was a fisher of men.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I really think that, you know, studying the childhood of Jesus and the adolescence and the young adulthood and his life in such detail really adds to your depth of not only knowledge, but your love. So I think that it's,
yeah, it's,
you know,
certainly
very,
Reggie,
very,
I mean,
profound.
I'm not saying that there shouldn't be that sort of ultimate reverence. Okay, but to make sure that that reverence is something that's achieved from the top down, first getting to the truth of Jesus, and then in the, you know, the depth of that truth, having that produce a profound feeling of reverence, as opposed to just, I'm being pushed up from the bottom even more than the New Testament, and I'm stalling out on the second level of meaning, and I just have this, you know, like I said, just mind-numbing, blind reverence that I diffuse myself into.
Right.
You know, you want to find the truth of Jesus first, because the truth of him is something worthy of your reverence. But just, you know, to just reverence him as a fetish man, it's just, you know, it's 180 degrees different, and that's the challenge. It's not that you don't reverence when all is said and done.
You reverence appropriately.
Yeah. Have it be a top-down achievement. Find the real living Jesus, you know, and how his truth can, you know, discover that his truth can be your truth. If he's a fetish man, then by definition, his truth cannot be your truth.
Right, I get that.
And his life is of utterly no relevancy to you, you know, except just as an object of veneration, you know, like Mount Ararat or something.
Hmm.
Ooh, look at the tall mountain with the snow on top.
I'm going to put this poster of Jesus on my wall, and that'll do.
I don't mean to be so dismissive, but, you know, it's just that one has to grab a hold of yourself by the collar and say, no, that's not what I'm meant to do with the life of Jesus.
Yeah. You know, I've got to say, this has been so exciting, this new arc. I mean, I'm really seeing the Master's life completely differently than I've ever seen it before. And I've read part four, I mean, more times than my fingers can count. But this right now, right here, this living experience I'm having with all of you and all of the listeners as we journey through this, it's been so exciting. I find myself, just the moment Tuesday I wake up, I'm like, yes, it's SOS day, and then, like, I can't wait to get in here. So I'm so grateful for all of you for participating in this with me.
Well, thank you, David. We're glad that you're here, and we're glad that all the listeners are here. And honestly, I hope that listeners out there take these approaches that we've been trying to cultivate here under Chris's able tutelage, and they apply it in their own settings. If you find yourself in a study group somewhere that's turning a study of part four into factoidism, see if you can throw a question out to the group that gets them, jars them out of that, like, you know, how many fish did Jesus catch by the time he was 17? And seeing who memorized enough facts, you know, and jar them out of it and get them saying, like, what does this mean to you? You can do this too. Any listener can do this too. You don't just have to listen to us. You can apply this.
But just make sure you're not blind before you try to help that blind person.
Like, right, take
there
the
is that
out of your own eyes.
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah, and again, you know, no one should demonize, you know, where they've been up to this point. Just, you know, hear the good news. There's so much more than you can be. Right? Everything can be built upon, no matter how unfortunate or, you know, ignorant or whatever. No, there's, because it's God's universe, there's always something in your, you know, in those thin threads of your past that are just that, threads that lead forward into the future. You know, so, I mean, most, you know, volume-wise, most of what I am right now is material, and then, you know, there's a little bit that's morontial, a little embryonic soul. Okay, mm-hmm. So quantity-wise, I'm mostly a blob of protoplasm. But, you know, as long as I have even just one little thread, you know, that's potentially eternal, that's of the truth, then it doesn't matter how unfortunate my life was factually for how many decades it was thus.
That's not so, counted against you in the tally somewhere, in some tally somewhere, no.
No, it literally is nothing.
Right.
Right. You know, so, you know, assess yourself in the truth, okay? But at the same time, don't go, well, you know, I'm pretty sure I've got this in the thread, so I don't have to really, you know, put a guard on my soul or worry about anything. And it's like, no. No. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a self-respect, but there is a sober, honest recognition of great limitation in your beginnings.
Yeah.
How much more likely am I to be in error than a Melchizedek who's lived for hundreds of millions of years?
Right. Yeah,
touche.
We'll get to the reading here. Just it sounds like it's the so-called Dunning-Kruger effect played out en masse across a whole human life. That thing where people who don't know much think they know everything, but it's usually applied to just specific topics. Oh, I know everything I need to know about house painting. I'm like, nope, you don't, and now your house looks awful. But no, this is about an entire life. Like, you know, yes, when I was 18, I thought I knew everything, but I didn't know what I didn't know. But like this is just humility is such a terrible condition. So
I mean,
with the humility.
Even all the revelators, they're only assigned a topic where they know of that which they speak, but they don't know of everything that they could speak on. And so they weren't assigned that task. It's like, oh, you're a divine counselor? Okay, well, you know this and this. Okay, so you can do that. But no, you can't do that because you don't know that which you speak there.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I mean, they give you that great example of what you're bringing up there, Brad, just with the authors.
Sure.
You know, if those on high knew everything, there'd be one author to this book.
And the Dunning-Kruger is just a fallacy. How much more significance is it when detecting sophistry? Big difference.
Well,
so,
yeah.
You start out humble and work forward. Go ahead, Brad. I'm sorry.
Just a point of clarification. Mm-hmm. What is this Kruger word you're using?
It's easy to look up. It's just the problem where people who don't know much think they know a whole lot because they don't know what they don't know. They haven't learned how big the world is yet. So just think of an 18-year-old. The problem is people. Yeah.
Is it
then there's
Kruger?
The flip.
Spell it out for Dr. Dunning.
Kruger. Or I may have flipped a couple of letters in there, but your search engine will fix
it.
Yeah, it's just an observation of human psychology, you know. And then once you do know what you don't know, you become very humble if you grow in that. And, you know, you get to where you hardly want to say anything about anything because you're like, I'm no Melchizedek.
Okay.
Chris, I thought it was very appropriately timed that you mentioned that about mistakes since we had the daily email that we get sent out. Today it said, be not downcast by your failure, wholly to forget some of your regrettable experiences. The mistakes which you fail to forget in time will be forgotten in eternity. I know there's a big if there somewhere. You know, it's either before or after this.
Obviously, if you ascend, then eternity, you know, can fix time. Okay. But you know, notice even there. Okay, that's going a notch above, leveraging off of Melchizedek as an example here. I mean, that's just error with Melchizedek. Yeah, but right there, it's mistakes. Okay, evil, actually evil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, you're looking back on your life. Okay, you're not just regretting an error, but you're literally regretting evil.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know, and it's like, well, I've never been evil. It's like, well, okay, in the Rancho book, they tell you evil is actually inescapable. Everyone who's ever lived, including Jesus, could look back on evil.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, but sin, okay, that's a different matter. You know, Jesus doesn't look back on sin, but he looks back on error and evil, but he's delighted in how he overcame those feet
mm-hmm.
of clay. Just knowing that, you know, you will innately embody error and evil, unless you challenge that nature and transcend it. Otherwise, it dooms you. I mean, you have to get above those feet of clay.
Yeah.
So, it's just not having any delusions about where you were brought into existence here. You are as far removed in nature as possible, and yet still have a thin little thread of potential to get to eternity. You know, if you extend a creature just one tiny little bit farther away from eternity than you are, then it's impossible for them to ever get to eternity.
Right.
That's your nature. Yeah, I mean, clearly revealed in the fifth epical revelation, right? Lest there be any, you know, delusional confusion here. That's what you really are, they say. Now, let me reemphasize the good news, you know, that even though you are oh so minimal, you've been given everything and more so that that you need to overcome that lowly estate if you take delight in cultivating.
Yeah.
If you actually, you know, utilize those gifts as opposed to being satisfied with the delights of the material existence. Yeah, so Jesus was, there's a bunch of things we can talk about this when we get into the reading, because it's an immediate topic in what we're going to read tonight. So we don't have to vamp endlessly on it here up front. But it's a great preface to, again, we just need to keep reemphasizing why it's so important to study very precisely what's going on with young Jesus here.
Amen.
Because you have to literally see this footprint and step in it, and then his next footprint and step in that, and then his next footprint and step in that one.
Yeah.
You have to follow what he did to overcome the feet of clay.
All right, well, thank you, Chris. Let's get on with the reading. We are in paper 125 of the Urantia Papers, Jesus at Jerusalem. Tonight, it's section 2, Jesus and the Passover. All right, we're on page 1379 of the original printing of these papers. Five Nazareth families were guests of or associates with the family of Simon of Bethany in the celebration of the Passover, Simon having purchased the Paschal lamb for the company. It was the slaughter of these lambs in such enormous numbers that had so affected Jesus on his temple visit. It had been the plan to eat the Passover with Mary's relatives, but Jesus persuaded his parents to accept the invitation to go to Bethany.
And, of course, it's very important to note them calling it the Paschal Lamb. Right? In other words, to immediately put it in play with ecclesiastical Greek, founding the the Christian theology, you know, where you take the P and the L, Paschal and Lamb, and you capitalize them, and the Christ is the Paschal Lamb.
The sacrifice, yeah.
You know, he is the Lamb of God, you know, the Agnus
sure.
Deo. He is the Paschal Lamb in Christian theology. You know, and so immediately you're thinking, wow, that is just, you know, bizarrely ironic that, you know, he is just, you know, like we're going to read the next paragraph, he is, you know, it's literally giving him nightmares, the whole concept of the Paschal Lamb. Okay, and when all is said and done, he becomes the personification of the Paschal Lamb. You capitalize the P and the L. Okay, but then
wow.
You got to flip it around. It's like, well, wait a minute. That wasn't just a coincidence when all of a sudden I came. You know, he obviously knew full well towards the end of his public ministry, you know, with his creator son awareness, right, that it would be very likely, if not certain, that those, you know, on this planet after he left would put him into the sin sacrifice and atonement scheme and analogize him as the Paschal Lamb if he surrendered up his life sort of precisely there at Passover. So, you know, he could have easily prevented that from happening. You know, he could have made it so they, you know, killed him 3 months later.
Yeah.
Instead of then. So you go, so in other words, by the time he kind of gets to the end of his public ministry, like we've said many times, you know, he's on, you know, how about plan triple Z, you know? You know, he's going, you know, I think I just have to play into the Supreme's evolutionary system here. I'm going to make it very easy for this to get incorporated into evolutionary religion. I'm going to literally, you know, just let this happen. Right at the most inappropriate time if you don't want him to become the personification of the Paschal Lamb. Yeah. So it's just interesting to think about how much he comes full circle relative to him right now, you know, where he is just utterly repulsed by all this. Right? And then eventually, like, oh, well, let's kind of roll with the thing here.
Yeah. The difference in poise that he exhibits from one time to the other and, like, maturity and growth, like that, you could see his progression and how far he has to go from being this repulsed to being like, yeah, I think the shoe fits. I'm going to wear it.
I mean, he knows full well that, you know, hundreds of years of prophets, you know, had told the Hebrews, the Jews, you know, it's like, no, not sacrifice, you know, et cetera. You know, but it hadn't changed anything because, you know, that just has to evolve in due time. And, you know, he recognized it's not the fullness of time. He's coming as a bestowal son completely out of context, right? You barely have a first epical revelation in play, you know, let alone, you know, all the normal predicates to a bestowal son. You know, and so, you know, part of him is just, you know, I mean, you know, remember he's achieving this relationship to supremacy. And so fully submitting yourself to the evolutionary facts of supremacy, you know, is part of what he's doing, right? What he's achieving. Knowing full well it's going to take a long time to overcome, you know, a million years of sin, sacrifice, and atonement.
Although, you know, just on that a little more, we have the Last Supper recounted for us here in the Urantia book. Like, they seem to be demonstrating Jesus would never have gone so far as to actually say the words, "This is my blood and this is my body for you."
Right.
Like, he would not have actively fed into this sacrificial atonement system, it was very easy for people to recount it that way. I mean, I guess I'm saying that as opposed to like the midwayers, like, well, he actually did play into it, but we're going to restate in modern phraseology and leave that out because they need to, like, no, Jesus wouldn't have said that. It would have been untruthful because
right.
That's not my blood. That's not my body.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, he obviously didn't, you know, but, you know, no matter what he said, you know, the fact remains he allowed himself, you know, to be killed right there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, they were going to push him off a cliff, and he just turned around and walked through them.
That's true.
Yeah,
I mean,
not my time. Yeah, not today, Satan.
It's like, so again, he's just, you know, but all of a sudden then you got to notice, okay, so he did, again, so that's, you know, that's the maturity of, I mean, you know, like we pointed out, I mean, he's, you know, in his public ministry, he's not just this man, you know, that is trying to transcend his feet of clay anymore, but nonetheless, he's still going through a learning process, you know, of, that is why he, you know, a creator son is incarnate in the flesh. There's just no other way except experientially to fully come to terms with, yes, you're personalized deity, you're a god, but prince of personalized deity than you, creator son. There's a hierarchy. And see, and that's another thing, you know, that is so jarring about the fifth epical revelation is having to deal with the hierarchical nature of the footprints of deity, you know, in reality. There's big, but there's always bigger. You know, gods and, you know, creators and creatures have to submit, right, to the hierarchy. Even the Universal Father put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so there's a hierarchy. And, you know, that the how automatic humility is once you submit to a hierarchy, and how the concept of anarchy, the plane, you know, is the expression of pride in contrast to humility.
Wow. That's an expansion.
You know, you will not put me in some, you know, down in some deep level of some hierarchy. No, I'm going to flatten everything out in a plane. You know, I am I. And that's, you know, that's pride driven. You know, that scheme of no hierarchy, anarchy.
Oh, wow.
All right. Anyway, yeah.
Right.
So, just the whole reason, you know, the Paschal Lamb is, you know, is one of our keywords is because, yeah, right. That's just, you know, you can't help but notice if you have a Christian upbringing, it's like, oh, that's the midway is just called it the Paschal Lamb instead of the Passover Lamb. Interesting.
Yeah. That night they assembled for the Passover rites, eating roasted flesh, unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Jesus, being a new son of the covenant, was asked to recount the origin of the Passover, and this he well did, but he somewhat disconcerted his parents by the inclusion of numerous remarks mildly reflecting the impressions made on his youthful but thoughtful mind by the things which he had recently seen and heard. This was the beginning of the seven-day ceremony of the Feast of the Passover.
Brad, your connection is chipping out every second or two there. You know, it's just like regular cutting out. We can understand everything you said, but maybe you should try reconnecting or something.
I'll try that while you're commenting.
All right. So So here you have you know, him engaging with the normal theological framework of the Jews, but you know, they're they're you know, reminding us of what he's doing right now. You know, how much his mind is grinding on this whole issue of, like we pointed out, okay, so he got to that first kind of just touching your finger on the wall, as it were, of being born again. You know, and so you rotate 180 degrees and now try to found things on eternity. Okay, but you know, there's just an infinite amount of work that has to be done to sort that out. Because when you flip, your perspective 180 degrees like that, I mean, it just puts everything that you were seeing before in complete turmoil. Right? It's like taking your well-settled snow globe and and shaking it. Okay. Everything is just all a swirl, okay, in Jesus' young mind here now. And he's got so much work to do to try to, to sort this out. They say to his youthful, he's got a lot of work to do yet. Okay, but thoughtful, so he's beginning. He can't help but have a lot of that burning passion of his sixth adjutant, It's like, I have to sort of say something, he's struggling, to even get, some reins put on that wild horse, right? Get a bridle on that horse. You see him, like you were commenting in the review, he can now be fanatical. Unless he really finds a bridle, right? Quick. So you're seeing that. And we'll talk a little bit more about this as they continue to kind of unpack that. But it's a key thing that they want you to kind of see, follow Jesus, through here.
Yeah.
Did Brad get back in?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope I'm here.
Oh, yeah, there you go. You're clear up. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Even at this early date, though he said nothing about such matters to his parents, Jesus had begun to turn over in his mind the propriety of celebrating the Passover without the slaughtered lamb. He felt assured in his own mind that the Father in heaven was not pleased with this spectacle of sacrificial offerings, and as the years passed, he became increasingly determined someday to establish the celebration of a bloodless Passover.
Okay, see, so what is he doing? Again, like I was just saying, he is fully kind of initiated this reformation.
Okay, yeah,
but a key part of that, if you're not going to lose your place in the kingdom, once you transcend the theology that you were born and raised in, and that allowed you to be born again, right? Despite the values in that theology, the supreme values could be base or even false, like we remind everyone all the time. Okay, but nonetheless, it was a theology. It was a logic of God, not just a notion of God, a logic of God, right? Mm. And within the wholeness of that logic, no matter how benighted, it allowed young Jesus to be born again, and even beyond that, to get well on the way to this, renewal of being born again. Okay, but even being born again, okay, it's not guaranteed to stay in the kingdom. The only way to stay in the kingdom is to have your mind formed in a wholeness of logic. And of course, in the upper domain, a logic predicated on truth, in other words, a true logic, okay, there has to be a logic of God, a holistic system. Right? See, and so he needs to reconstruct an entire theology in his upper domain, an entire theology in his personal living philosophy. If he doesn't, he won't remain in the kingdom. And that's when the revelators, you know, often point to this, you know, this very dangerous step where someone, you know, maybe just because of scientific education or something, you know, comes to be aware of, you know, say the superstitious or false or limited nature of the theology that they were born into. And, you know, yes, they you know, that means that they need to transcend that theology, or that they are, you know, beginning to transcend that theology. But people, you know, that's why the Darkenment began, because as soon as people began to transcend the theology they were born into, they didn't replace it with an upstepped theology. They falsely thought, well, no, I don't need any theology at all, but I'm still
right.
going to be, you know, in God's favor. It's like, no, you're not. Okay, you have no way to stay in the kingdom without the wholeness of a logic of God. Right? The Jewish people had constructed a very vast wholeness, right, of a logic of God. And Jesus is, you know, knows full well that he's going to have to really work on this, as they're going to talk about him doing, because he knows he has to construct a whole, you know, transcendent theology. You know, he doesn't have the delusional thought that somehow he can exist without that holistic harmonization with the cosmos. No, I can stand as a part, and my partness is wholeness. You know, it's like, no, it's not. Your partness is just partness. If you have no conformity with the wholeness of the cosmos, you're not righteous. If you're not wearing the robe of righteousness, you're kicked out of the kingdom, as it were.
And he would also know. Oh, sorry.
You're breaking up, Brad.
Yeah, he's breaking up again.
Maybe you're not even here.
He might have to call back in. Yeah. Well, you know, I see at the end here as he's entertaining the thought of being able to celebrate a bloodless Passover, this is already his transcendence of the logic that he was raised in, and he's passing this challenge. He's aligning logically with the cosmos. He's being righteous. He's entertaining the thought that someday the truth of this will continue without the error. I can leave the error out of it. I can have a bloodless Passover. There's no need for that sacrifice. And he's like, he's entertaining this. He's thinking the truth. This is that sincerity that you talk about. The true wholeheartedness comes from that thinking in the upper domain, like he's doing here.
Yeah, and notice he doesn't, you know, he isn't determined someday to have a religion without Passover.
Right.
Which is what happened at the beginning of the 20th century in so much degree. You know, you threw the baby out of the bathwater.
Yeah.
Right. And Darkenment gave rise to, or Enlightenment gave rise to Darkenment. And so,
well, and he's also, I hope you all hear me now.
Okay, yeah,
the
go
comment
ahead,
I want to make, he's also not doing a thing that is very popular these days of just doing ritual substitution. Like, he could have, quote unquote, established the celebration of a bloodless Passover the day he, you know, turned 18 or moved from underneath his parents. You know, house, their roof. But no, what you're saying is you wouldn't do that. That would, you know, these are not just rituals. They are pointing to something that is true. And in order to remain logical with all of this, he has to construct an entire theology that works with the bloodless Passover. It's not just a ritual,
yeah.
Much more.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, you are breaking up still, Brad, but yeah, I mean, what you're saying, I was just getting at there, that he recognizes the truth of how Passover fits into the Jewish theology, and he needs to maintain that truth, you know, but upstep the, you know, the factual, you know, nature of the theology.
Hmm.
you know, there's a truth that he conserves, while he, you know, would obviously be radically transforming, you know, the detailed structure of this theology. And even if he doesn't actually try to produce, you know, a socially manifesting theology, I mean, now, like I was getting at before, I mean, you know, remember that technically religion is a purely individual fact. But to think that you are religious without a theology is delusional.
Hmm.
There is no reality of you as a religionist if you don't have a theology in the in your inner domain. If you don't have a
logic of God
there.
Yeah.
But Chris,
wow.
But you know, the problem is that you know, you mentioned the Hebrews and how they really had it dialed in. Nowadays we don't at all, and yet people are expected to have this theology. Where are they supposed to find it?
Well, the same place that Jesus found it. He didn't find it by going on the internet and finding a, you know,
no,
a better evolutionary religion.
And he had a religion, and all of these things work together. Nowadays, we're incredibly impoverished, not to mention being, you know, on this sin-stricken and evil-dominated world. And it's pretty rough down here.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, what technically what's in play here is someone who is genuinely religious, but then, is ascending here philosophically, and you know, has to rework everything within their personal living philosophy in their inner domain. Okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean, again, if Jesus had been born and raised secular, he wouldn't have survived. Yeah, and you've got to, you know, you can't somehow magically, right, you bootstrap yourself up. There has to be these initial booster rockets strapped to you. And once those get you up high enough in altitude, then you can, you know, blow those booster rockets off and you can take it to the rest of the way from, you know, by yourself. Okay?
Well, that certainly leaves little hope for anybody, you know, nowadays. So many people are being raised in a secular society, secular home. I mean, even churches are secular anymore, so hope anyone
Does. Again, like we don't sort of have to go off on that tangent like we often do. I've tried to make it very clear that, you know, the unwitting actual secularists, that's the emergency, right, that produced this revelation in the first place. Right. I mean, it's, you know, it's not just civilizational darkness, but individual darkness is the only destiny, you know, in the near term for a world like this. Okay. Even in Jesus's time, he told them, you know, you need to go out and save people. Okay. I mean, how much more would he tell you that now? Okay. But back to this issue of, you know, if you've been fortunate enough to have been raised in a definitive, you know, religious, theological context, even if it's like, you know, the Jewish theology that was very material-based, I mean, so much of it was a religion of matter, not even a religion of mind, but nonetheless, okay, there's this wholeness that's been established very purposely, theological wholeness, and within which he could be born again. If one has, you know, gotten up there to altitude and is ready to start taking on, you know, this yourself, you must do this. You know, you can't somehow think, oh well, I don't need some sort of philosophic framework for my belief in God. I mean, I can just believe in God and, you know, define however is pleasant to me. Obviously make it to paradise with that. No. Okay. I mean, technically, even though you think you're spiritual but not religious, okay, you're technically not even spiritual.
Hmm.
You know, you're just a material mind that is hopelessly delusional.
Yeah, there's no
thinking that somehow matter is spirit. when they're infinitely separated. Yeah. So, you know, that, you know, see, that's what Jesus is doing, and it's indispensable, right? You, I mean, so again, you can see, you know, the place of the fifth epical revelation, you know, in helping with this, you know, even if it's all just you, you know, it doesn't go beyond you in any socialized way at all, but each of us must establish a genuine theology, a logic of God in our inner domain so that we are secured in the kingdom. Right? You can only latch on to the cosmos with a spherical grip. That conformity with the cosmos. You have to have that sphere of logic. I mean, even if it's just even if the extent of your philosophy is just merely the logic of God, and, you know, you don't have any logic of paleontology or particle physics yet, okay? But, you know, there has to at least be a logic of God that secures you spherically to the cosmos. You can't just do it as a point particle.
And what was the etymology of logic again? Was it logos?
I mean the literalness of it, see, you know, is pretty minimal, okay? But, you know, there's a spirit there, there's an essence there, you know, that once you have the fifth epical revelation to, I mean, remember, humans have never been able to figure out, you know, exactly what's the difference in logic and reason, you know, and what does the word philosophy really mean? I mean, see, again, the fifth epical revelation is trying to actually get you to be able to define these terms, right? And, but see, even though they couldn't sort of consciously sort it out, there has been a logic of God. Right? It's just that they weren't clear about how that's a spherical, you know, fact analogously and not a linear fact or something like that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the Urantia book can help you know, make it clear what you're trying to do. You have to put your belief in God in a frame, right, that is not of your own desire, but which you submit yourself to exist within. Then you're religious.
Yeah.
Amen.
So, you know, theology has gotten a very bad name. I mean, so has metaphysics.
Yeah.
But the fifth epical revelation, no. There's a truth to theology. There's a truth to metaphysics. It doesn't matter how, you know, pitiful human thoughts about them have been. The only reason there are pitiful theologies is because for some curious reason, transcendent of you, you're driven to somehow form a theology. What's up with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, God, it's literally built into you that you just can't help yourself, and, you know, when you become a serious thinker about God, that you end up constructing a theology. It's just, you know, it's because you need it. And see, you're literally hardwired. You know, it's like being hardwired to pray, hardwired to, you know, form a theology, no matter how superstitious or materialistic or whatever. Why are we driven like that? Because you need it. It's indispensable.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that's,
you see Jesus doing that here. You see him forming that theology. You could see, like, this is a display of him utilizing his first and third cosmic intuition. You can see how he sees the truth, the value, the goodness in the Passover. But he's using his logical acumen, his first cosmic intuition, to really sort and sift out the error and the thing that's not necessary. And he's enabling
that. Yeah, they're
going to
address that very, you know, explicitly here in the next paragraph, we'll see. You know? Like I said, they just keep building on this.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I'm highlighting it. It's the theme, okay, that they're presenting here.
Hmm. Well, David, you want to take the reading from here?
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Brad.
Your voice is cleared up, Brad.
All right.
Sounds great. Jesus slept very little that night. His rest was greatly disturbed by revolting dreams of slaughter and suffering. His mind was distraught and his heart torn by the inconsistencies and absurdities of the theology of the whole Jewish ceremonial system. His parents, likewise, slept little. They were greatly disconcerted by the events of the days just ended. They were completely upset in their own hearts by the lad's, to them, strange and determined attitude. Mary became nervously agitated during the fore part of the night, but Joseph remained calm, though he was equally puzzled. Both of them feared to talk frankly with the lad about these problems, though Jesus would gladly have talked to his parents if they had dared to encourage him.
Jesus is trying to be respectful and just staying silent. So, you know, all they would have done is say, no, it's okay, Jesus. You know, what's on your mind, right?
But see how they use the word determined, and that was disconcerting for them to think that they, you know, he must have been not compliant the way so many other children back in those days were compliant. And I think they called it, you know, being determined. And that must have kind of been strange for them.
Yeah, and again, see, you know, I mean, right away, as soon as he begins to manifest, you know, a phenomenon that, you know, is based upon eternity, the reaction of everyone around is, well, you know, he must be beside himself. Strange. And you know, and of course, you know, like the favorable conditions, I often say you should be determined to be loyal. You should be determined to be humble.
Yeah.
You see, right? You see it right there, that he's manifesting that, you know, that consecration based upon something that, you know, even his parents know nothing of, recognize
not. Yeah.
they've never experienced this depth of consecration, so they have no idea what's going on with him. All they conclude is he's a little off, apparently.
His feet changed from being from the bottom to the top.
Yeah. Right. You know, and again, we see, you know, it's always just a little bit unnerving, you know, when they point out this isn't just some temperamental, you know, confusion. No, they were upset in their own hearts. Whenever they emphasize that, they're doing that so you recognize that anything like this, if you start to spiritualize, you know, if you start to put your reaction under personality management, you know, a dislike under personality management, an unpleasantness under personality management, that's very problematic, right? It doesn't mean, you know, you're condemned to oblivion instantly, okay, but you do not want to stay on that path.
Right.
Right? So, but again, you know, the main thing, you can see they actually use the word theology, see? And they use those two philosophic assessments, inconsistencies and absurdities. See, you know, his budding philosophic insight, you know, is what's powering his newfound quest for a transcendent reformation of himself.
Mm.
See, I mean, you know, if you're just merely religious, you don't have any issue with inconsistency or absurdity. But the moment you start to be a religionist of philosophic attainment,
yeah,
I mean, those inconsistencies scream at you just as loudly as, you know, your reverence for God.
Yeah, they don't fly any longer.
And you cannot, you know, somehow abide with those inconsistencies and absurdities. There cannot be peace between truth and falsehood.
He now is
facing that severe test that so many years later he would tell everyone that they would eventually face. He's facing that severe test. Can he maintain himself in the kingdom? You know, or is he going to fail to, you know, to sort this out, and hence snuff out the, you know, the light of faith, and you know, forsake his spiritual birth? The severe test. Yeah, you know, we all know. Okay, he's consecrated very firmly. You're not going. You know, nothing is going to shake it. He is going to figure this out. If he has to just sit there and stare at the wall for 5 years, he's going to figure this out.
He's determined.
Yes, he's determined. I will not forsake the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
The delights there are too great. I will not lose it. Right, see, and again, it's not a futile thought because he's encircled in the Holy Spirit. He has everything he needs to achieve this reformed personal living philosophy. All he has to do is be determined, and it will come to pass. As long as you don't doubt, you will achieve.
Mm-hmm. The next day's services at the temple were more acceptable to Jesus and did much to relieve the unpleasant memories of the previous day. The following morning, young Lazarus took Jesus in hand, and they began a systematic exploration of the Jerusalem and its environs. Before the day was over, Jesus discovered the various places about the temple where teaching and question conferences were in progress. And aside from a few visits to the Holy of Holies to gaze in wonder and as to what really was behind the veil of separation, he spent most of his time about the temple at these teaching conferences.
So, again, just reflect on that. Where is he? He has some interest in that kind of nuclear religious reverence issue. It's the Holy of Holies. But his primary quest here, you know, is for philosophic expansion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a hunger for that.
He's hungering for truth now.
Uh-huh.
See, not just hungering and thirsting for righteousness, right, but he's building upon the thirst for righteousness with an insatiable hunger for truth.
Yeah, because he's got that righteous foundation already.
Yeah. See, I mean, you know, we talked about the, you know, initial, you know, hints at that, you know, earlier in his life. You know, he was very definitively on this path. But, you know, it's becoming all the more just undeniable to him. I mean, it's like, you know, he could easily forget that he has to actually water now. I mean, truth and righteousness have become dominant over his biologic urges for food and water.
And parents? What parents?
And parents and everything, yeah. Who is my mother? Who are my brothers? I mean, see, you can just see how that is in play very definitively now, as it has to be. You know, if we weren't getting this description, you would know that my statement that he had gotten to born again was invalid, right? Yeah. But see, the only way to understand where he is right now, what he's manifesting, is like, no, this boy has been born again. He's definitively on the path to adulthood. Yeah, he's an adolescent. He's on the path to adulthood now, right? So, spiritual adulthood, you know, is what he sees, the distance, and nothing is going to prevent him from getting there.
It's interesting in this paragraph that he, am I correct, that he gets to spend this day just being given a tour of the city by Lazarus. Like, his parents are not with him like they were on the day before. His father's not with him. So he's getting that burgeoning independence by way of an expert young lad who already knows his way around the city, I guess. Convenient.
Yeah. And you know, and again, his parents have, you know, I mean, even Mary recognizes, you know, that, you know, she literally couldn't nail him to the ground and keep him from this.
Yeah. Right. Off he goes.
Hey.
He's always been adventurous and aggressive, yes.
Just try to breathe slowly, Mom. I'm out of here.
Oh, man. I love how they just very poetically say, well, aside from a few visits to the Holy of Holies, of course, you know, just to gaze and wonder. But he really, I love how they're like, what was really behind the veil of separation there? Almost like, you know, you could see him squinting his eyes as he walks by, like, uh-huh.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the few visits
really
is
there.
Over many, many days, right? You know, so, yeah, you kind of see he sort of has he's touching bases with the religious foundation, right, just to make sure he's still grounded, you know, that
yeah.
the sphere he's trying to expand is still, you know, centered on religion, on God, okay, but, you know, his primary focus is, no, I want to see how much I can expand this sphere.
Throughout the Passover week, Jesus kept his place among the new sons of the commandment, and this meant that he must seat himself outside the rail which segregated all persons who were not full citizens of Israel. Being thus made conscious of his youth, he refrained from asking the many questions which surged back and forth in his mind. At least he refrained until the Passover celebration had ended and these restrictions on the newly consecrated youths were lifted.
Yeah. So again, you can see, you know, we've talked about, you know, some of the lesser ways he's begun to bridle himself. So they're emphasizing more of that. Right? You know, he's getting control of himself, but man, is he champing at the bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, okay, so, you know, at what, you know, not just minute, but what fraction of a minute am I free? Because I've got a question I'm going to blurt out the second I can.
You can just see, like, he's stretching his arm up high. Me, I got one. I got a question.
But not because he wants to be, pardon the phrase, a little turd. Like, he's that philosophic hunger. Like, he wants to engage in this stuff. He's eager, and it's thoroughly sincere. It's not dissembling.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are educated men of God that he gets to converse with. And, he's excited.
That religious nucleus around the philosophic sphere, see, you know, it. So that it's a true philosophic spirit. It doesn't mean it's not merely him wanting, you know, a greater philosophic picture. He knows he must achieve it. See, that religious nucleus turns want into must.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's the word must so many times in the Revelation.
Yeah.
See, and if you don't respond every time you read must in the Revelation with that, you know, giddy up, go. See, that's basically telling you you're not religious. Because a religionist, when they see must, you know, in a text like this, you know, or coming from the mouth of someone they respect, I mean, they drop everything and go, you know, their ears perk up. They're like, wait a minute, I must do that?
Yeah. And it's
they
not
respond
just their
religiously
ears
to that, like, you know, we always say.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not just their ears perking up. Their tail starts wagging, too. I mean, like, they're happy. You know?
Yeah, and of course, that's what Jesus was trying to, it's like, you know, yeah, you should hear that. But, you know, don't just get all super serious and legalistic, you know, with yourself. No, your tail should be wagging too.
Yeah.
It should be your delight.
This is a good time. I'm excited. Let's go. Yeah, yeah.
Right. That was his whole message in his public ministry, right? You know, when you're instructed about the requirements of righteousness, wag your tail. You know, and be excited to get at it.
Yeah.
Right. Do it because you love God. Not because you fear him.
Right.
But to do it is still there. One way or another, you got to do it. If you can only do it because of fear, okay, at least you're in the kingdom. Okay? But he's trying to give people the good news. It doesn't have to be this crushing burden that you heap on yourself.
Yeah. Andrea, would you like to take over reading from here?
On Wednesday of the Passover week. Okay, hold on. The screen just disappeared. Sorry about that. On Wednesday of the Passover week, Jesus was permitted to go home with Lazarus to spend the night at Bethany. This evening, Lazarus, Martha, and Mary heard Jesus discuss things temporal and eternal, human and divine, and from that night on, they all three loved him as if he had been their own brother.
Now, I probably don't have to point out what you should immediately think of in parallel, do I?
Oh, it's our weekly paper 102 dose.
It's like, okay, I'm not going between the lines here, okay? This right on the lines here, guys.
Pretty obvious in those
it's
words.
It's like, right. Yeah. See, he can talk to Lazarus, Martha, and Mary about how there's this saving faith that's had a birth in my human heart. My moral consciousness has realized that human values may be translated in mortal experience from the material to the spiritual, from the human to the divine, from time to eternity. Let me tell you about it. It's so exciting. Right? See, you can literally, see how they're highlighting. I mean, if it's a passage I highlight often, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can literally see them indicating that mile marker in Jesus' life.
Right.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's interesting.
And look what he's doing here. He's becoming a righteousness recommender.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A transcendent righteousness, one that's founded on that which is above, okay? Rather than trying to struggle up from that which is below.
Yeah.
See, one that's liberated of material gravity. One that's free because you know the truth.
Hmm.
Right? See, all those things that he used to emphasize in the public ministry, he knows of that which he speaks.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So he can speak about them with authority. When they see him, wow, this guy says things like he's the one of authority. Okay, and historically we've interpreted that as, he's God and all this. No. He knows of that which he speaks. He's experientially acquired that.
Yeah, he's had the personal recognitions of them.
Right. He can speak to it intimately. Okay. But, everyone else is like, well, I have no idea, where that's coming from. Some people, like the apostles, just said, well, I guess, I love him, so I'll just follow him. But, man, I have no idea where he gets this stuff.
Yeah, they stopped asking. You only have to ask that once before you realize, okay. I'm not going to find this in a book. I'm just going to take his word for it.
Right. But obviously, it's of all human knowledge, et cetera, okay? See, because the revelators are encouraging us, do likewise. Follow the path he tread.
Mm-hmm.
Free yourself.
By the end of the week, Jesus saw less of Lazarus, since he was not eligible for admission to even the outer circle of the temple discussions, though he attended some of the public talks delivered in the outer courts. Lazarus was the same age as Jesus, but in Jerusalem, youths were seldom admitted to the consecration of sons of the law until they were a full 13 years of age.
So you have the immediate cultural context and stuff that's producing these vignettes. Okay, but, you know, notice, you know, we have courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Okay, I mean, first he's, you know, like you mentioned, David, he's, you know, going around with Lazarus. Okay, on Wednesday night, you know, he's literally, you know, saying goodbye to mom and dad and Mary's relatives, and he's going to Bethany, staying overnight. You know, and here, right, he's even, soldiering forward without Lazarus as his wingman.
Yeah.
See?
Wow.
He's just, all
boys.
All the training wheels are coming off, see?
Yeah.
That's neat. Again and again, during the Passover week, his parents would find Jesus sitting off by himself with his youthful head in his hands, profoundly thinking. They had never seen him behave like this, and not knowing how much he was confused in mind and troubled in spirit by the experience through which he was passing, they were sorely perplexed. They did not know what to do. They welcomed the passing of the days of the Passover week and longed to have their strangely acting son safely back in Nazareth.
He's like, oh, please, don't let him get us in prison or something worse.
Yeah, we use this for the blurb because it, I mean, see, again, it embodies this profoundly thinking, right, and how he knows he must, you know, form a new logic of God. I mean, so it is just, you know, the only thought really in his mind. You know, and it's like I said, you know, he's going to likely forget that he has to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
and
he
has to do this largely on his own two feet. I mean, he's got supporters, you know, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus are like, we love you. Preach on, brother.
Yeah.
But for the most part, people are going to think he's a little odd, a little strange. So he's got to just do this anyway.
Yep. Yeah. And again, like I said, he knows he must do this, right? I mean, because you know he is beginning to understand what the revelers, what the midwares tell us, you know, in the passage about the Phoenician appearance, right up there in paper 193. The Father requires that you grow up to the full stature of spiritual adulthood. Yeah, there's grace that allows you to take whatever time you need. Okay, but, you know, you must have that destiny, and you must be determined to reach that destiny. The Father requires that you grow up. He doesn't desire that you grow up. He requires it.
And you know the strange thing is, like, when you start off on that, you assume, like, how can I get there? I'm not capable of getting there. But just the fact alone of you having that desire to do so creates within you enough favorable condition for that capacity expansion. And then you're gifted with grace with a little bit more, you know, coincidentally, just to get you to that next step, you know. It's like you keep submitting, and the deeper you submit, the more you're graced with this opportunity to take advantage of it and utilize it.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it because you have access to the mindedness of the creative Mother Spirit. She already did it, therefore you can do it as long as you dwell therein, as long as you have a consecration of mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. It's just a matter of time then. But you must... Right? Because the Father transcendently, existentially requires you to achieve that end. So again, you can play, see around in some of the significant passages in the book and see how, you know, this all fits together in one logical system. We have a theology being offered to us here. We have a logic of God being offered to us here.
Yeah. Here we go. Day by day, Jesus was thinking through his problems, By the end of the week, he had made many adjustments, but when the time came to return to Nazareth, his youthful mind was still swarming with perplexities and beset by a host of unanswered questions and unsolved problems.
Right, because there's an infinite number of questions that have to be answered. I see, so, and he's not yet, doesn't have his sea legs yet, so this is a bit, discombobulating for him still, right? But you can see he's getting more comfortable with it, that the path to God is upstream like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to learn to be comfortable with that upstream, right?
Yeah.
That the only movement upstream is by your will. The moment there isn't will, right, you'll flow downstream again and you got to start over again.
Yeah.
That's a great analogy. Yeah.
Right? You have to just keep willing yourself upstream. Now and forevermore, through endless cycles of eternity.
So basically, we're salmon.
Yeah, yep. I was thinking that. Was
trying to get
too.
Back to where we were spawned, right?
Wow.
That's
you're God
crazy.
The Father seeking right now. You have to swim upstream.
And look how much momentum it takes to get upstream. It's not like you can limp upstream, right? It takes everything you got, pedal to the metal in order to make it up.
Yeah.
And there might be a bear waiting to snatch you out of the air.
Oh, there will be some bears.
Be careful when you leap out of the water to clear that waterfall.
Yeah.
Talk about needing your tail to wag all the way. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
here we go.
Effort, struggle, conflict, yes.
Faith, determination, love, loyalty, progress. Before Joseph and Mary left Jerusalem, in company with Jesus, Jesus's Nazareth teacher, they made definite arrangements for Jesus to return when he reached the age of 15 to begin his long course of study in one of the best-known academies of the rabbis. Jesus accompanied his parents and teacher on their visits to the school, but they were all distressed to observe how indifferent he seemed to all they said and did. Mary was deeply pained at his reactions to the Jerusalem visit, and Joseph was profoundly perplexed at the lad's strange remarks and unusual conduct.
More of that, where we could talk about, and you notice even the contrast, the way they describe Mary and Joseph. It's like, the Mary one is even more problematic there.
Deeply pained.
Potentially. Again, he recognizes he's completely begun, to form a whole new theology transcendent of theirs. He's not interested, in filling in more of the details of their vast, elaborate sphere of theology.
Their hollow sphere of theology.
It's like, if you asked him, he would say, it's a valid beginning sphere of theology, but, I'm kind of outgrown that one.
Yeah. Oh, man, you couldn't say that out loud.
But again, just that important step about as you're moving upward, if you're going to do psychic circle progress, if you're going to move up cosmic levels, I have a theology on the seventh circle. I need a transcendent theology on the sixth circle. I need a transcendent theology on the fifth circle. Okay, how many times have you reformed your theology?
Yeah,
that will tell you how many circles you've.
Oh, wow. It's like counting the age of a tree, right?
Yes. There's going to be a transcendent logic of God on a higher cosmic level, right? Just by definition. So, think about that. It's like, I'm going to make it to paradise without a theology. It's like, no, you're not even going to make it to the sixth circle. Okay? A little infusion.
Well, I had my bags packed. I was ready to wake up on the third day, Chris. What happened?
Yeah.
After all, Passover week had been a great event in Jesus' life. He had enjoyed the opportunity of meeting scores of boys about his own age, fellow candidates for the consecration, and he utilized such contacts as a means of learning how people lived in Mesopotamia, Turkestan, and Parthia, as well as in the far western provinces of Rome. He was already fairly conversant with the way in which the youth of Egypt and other regions near Palestine grew up. There were thousands of young people in Jerusalem at this time, and the Nazareth lad personally met and more or less extensively interviewed more than 150. He was particularly interested in those who hailed from the far eastern and remote western countries. As a result of these contacts, the lad began to entertain a desire to travel about the world for the purpose of learning how the various groups of his fellow men toiled for their livelihood.
See,
wow.
Jesus is a scientist again. See, because he knows very clearly now from a top-down point of view, it's impossible for him to expand the philosophic sphere in the absence of, a limited set of facts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the absence of greater facts, in the face of a limited set of facts. So he's very, hungry to collect all of the scientific, factual, data that he can get his hands on. Interviewing more than 150. Not
That's
just
a lot.
Watching them, okay? Interviewing them, this little 12-year-old.
And for the purpose of learning how they toiled for their livelihood. Now, how did they swim upstream?
Yeah.
Not to mention, what do they do so they don't starve to death?
Wonderful.
That scientific hunger, see, that is contained within his philosophic hunger. When he got this born again, he didn't, he didn't suddenly transcend science. No,
yeah.
He finally has true science in his mind.
Right.
Yep.
Do you want to move into section 3?
Yeah, we should be able to do some paragraphs there.
Okay, section 3, departure of Joseph and Mary. It had been arranged that the Nazareth party should gather in the region of the temple at mid-forenoon on the first day of the week after the Passover festival had ended. This they did and started out on the return journey to Nazareth. Jesus had gone into the temple to listen to the discussions while his parents awaited the assembly of their fellow travelers. Presently, the company prepared to depart, the men going in one group and the women in another, as was their custom in journeying to and from the Jerusalem festivals. Jesus had gone up to Jerusalem in company with his mother and the women. Being now a young man of the consecration, he was supposed to journey back to Nazareth in company with his father and the men. But as the Nazareth party moved on toward Bethany, Jesus was completely absorbed in the discussion of angels in the temple, being wholly unmindful of the passing of the time for the departure of his parents. And he did not realize that he had been left behind until the noontime adjournment of the temple conferences.
Right, so here the part of the story that always puts a twinkle in our eyes. It's so fun to think about this part of the story. Again, notice, Jesus has his parents so kind of off kilter, right? That they didn't even kind of think in the, absolutely, he's going back with. With my husband Joseph, because that's and Joseph would be thinking, it's like, no, well, he's Jesus. He may want to completely go against tradition and go back with mom and the women, So he's got both of the parents just so upended here.
Oh, poor things.
and of course, he's almost like, parents? I mean, who are they? Whatever.
When I read this paragraph, I was thinking, oh, it was before I read the next paragraph. I was thinking to myself, oh, I guarantee you there was some words spoken between these two about what happened. You know, you can just hear it, what might have gone down between the two of them. All right, here we go. The Nazareth travelers did not miss Jesus because Mary surmised he journeyed with the men, while Joseph thought he traveled with the women since he had gone up to Jerusalem with the women, leading Mary's donkey. They did not discover his absence until they reached Jericho and prepared to tarry for the night. After making inquiry of the last of the party to reach Jericho and learning that none of them had seen their son, they spent a sleepless night, turning over in their minds what might have happened to him, recounting many of his unusual reactions to the events of Passover week, and mildly chiding each other for not seeing to it that he was in the group before they left Jerusalem. Well, you know, he had to get the donkey. That's why I figured he was back there with you, Mary. And she's like, you're supposed to be in charge of him now that he is a son of the covenant. Come on.
Now, mild. Now, Andrea, it was mild. It was very mild. Yeah.
The midwares obviously have quotation marks that are invisible around that mildly. Yeah,
yeah. I was going to say.
So let's see how civilized you two are here. How are you going to respond to this little situation?
They were already in the previous couple paragraphs, like, I can't wait to hightail this. We got to get out of here before something bad happens to us or him or both.
Yeah.
Plus, they hadn't been sleeping well. They're all worried about things. Here's another night where they didn't sleep well.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And of course, this will continue until the day he dies and even beyond, you know, that Jesus, you know, just upsets everything.
Yeah, he really does.
Because he's a revelator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The revelation is Jesus of Nazareth. Okay?
Right. Revelations of any epical significance upset things. If you're interpreting what they're doing correctly, it can be a book, it can be a person. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, an epical revelation is completely not affirmation. You know, a little auto-revelation, you know, can kind of squeeze its way into the cracks amidst, you know, all of your self-satisfied affirmations. Okay, but an epical revelation, like you're saying, Brad, is completely upending.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You just cannot figure out how to assimilate it, you know, without starting from scratch.
Yeah.
That's why the courageous part is there in courageous and independent cosmic thinking. Because you need it. Not for those timid souls.
Well, the thing I'm going to really take away from this evening is, you know, let me be the salmon.
Yeah.
Swim upstream. Well, I'm going to think more about this theology, this building a logic of God, and you know, the minor rehabilitation we had of that word here tonight. That's a word that a lot of your Rancho Book readers think they don't need anymore, but of course you need it. It's important to think about that.
Yeah, see, if it's just a sequence of letters, it's just the word Bethel. No, it's the house of God.
Good night.
Right. There you go.
Same way with theology. Well, it's the logic of God.
Exactly. We'll leave it there, but there's plenty to think about with these words and with this revelation. So we hope to see you back here next Tuesday. Thanks for joining us this week. And until then, God bless and follow the way.
God bless, everybody. Have a great week.
Good night, everyone.
Take care, all. I hope everyone enjoyed this vigorous journey with Jesus. Let us find his footprints and then follow them in his faith. Talk to you next week, everyone. Bye for now.